When you get behind the wheel of a car, you don't really need to know how the fuel injection system works to, drive to the grocery store.
Right, exactly. You just press the pedal and go.
Yeah, you press the pedal, the car goes. And honestly, a lot of modern machine learning feels exactly the same way.
Oh, totally.
You import a Python library, you feed in a CSV file full of data, you call the train function, and out pops a prediction. It feels like absolute magic.
It really does feel like magic. But I mean, the danger of treating it that way is that when your model suddenly crashes or, it takes 3 weeks to train.
Yeah, or it starts spitting out just absolute garbage predictions.
Exactly. When that happens, you have absolutely no idea what's happening under the hood to fix it. You are entirely at the mercy of the black box.
Which is an incredibly frustrating place to be if you're an engineer or really just a researcher trying to build something real. And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We've got a stack of sources today covering what is historically considered a pretty dense topic, linear algebra, and specifically matrix decompositions.
Right, which sounds terrifying to a lot of people.
It does. But we are not going to just recite abstract textbook formulas at you. We're going to translate these concepts directly into the world of practical machine learning. We're going to show you how these mathematical operations act as the actual literal engines powering data science.
Because I think once you strip away the intimidation factor, you realize these aren't just like academic hurdles to clear in a university course.
Right.
These decompositions are the very reasons we are able to compress massive data sets or, build recommender systems and even render photorealistic 3D environments in real time.
So whether you're brushing up on your ML foundations for a big project at work, or you just genuinely love understanding the fundamental mechanics of the algorithm shaping our world, this deep dive is going to connect those theoretical dots to the physical reality of coding. And I have the perfect co-pilot joining me today to help cut through the mathematical noise, avoid the jargon, and, explain the deep why behind the numbers.
Well, I'm thrilled to be doing this. There is a there's a profound elegance in this math once you start seeing it as physical transformations of data rather than just symbols on a chalkboard.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the absolute core engine of it all, the concept that seems to pop up literally everywhere, eigenvectors and eigenvalues.
The classics.
Yeah. If we are talking about transforming data, we just have to start here. Because normally, when you multiply a vector by a matrix, it completely changes the vector's direction and magnitude, right? It just knocks it off its original path.
Right, it does.
But an eigenvector is unique.
Yeah, it's think of a matrix as an action, like a set of instructions that distort space. When that matrix acts on most vectors, they get rotated and pushed around. But an eigenvector is a special vector that perfectly resists being rotated by that specific
It
matrix.
just refuses to move.
Exactly. Its direction is entirely preserved. The only thing that happens to it is that it gets scaled by a specific number, which we call the eigenvalue.
Okay.
It might get stretched out if that eigenvalue is larger than one. It might get compressed if it's less than one. It could even be flipped backward if the eigenvalue is, negative, but it stays stubbornly on its original line.
I love trying to visualize this. Like, imagine you have a giant, highly elastic rubber sheet, and you've drawn straight arrows all over it, pointing out from the center in every possible direction.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Right. Now, grab the edges of that rubber sheet and stretch it unevenly. Like, pull incredibly hard on the left and right, but barely pull on the top and bottom.
That visual captures the geometry perfectly, yeah.
So if you look at the arrows after you've stretched the sheet, almost all of them are pointing in slightly different directions than they were before. They've been warped by the stretch. But a couple of those arrows, the ones pointing exactly along the horizontal and vertical lines where you were pulling, they're still pointing along their original paths. So they just got longer.
Right.
Those stubborn arrows that stayed on their lines, those are your eigenvectors. And the amount they physically stretched, that is your eigenvalue.
And finding those stubborn arrows conceptually is, well, it's a brilliant puzzle. Instead of looking at raw formulas, think about what we are actually trying to find.
Right, what's the goal?
We are looking for a state where applying the matrix transformation is mathematically identical to just multiplying by a single number. So to find that sweet spot, we subtract that scaling factor from the diagonal of our matrix and look for the exact moment the matrix collapses space.
Okay, wait, collapses space.
Yeah, we calculate the determinant, which measures the volume of our transformed space, and we set it to zero. When the volume hits zero, boom, we found our eigenvalues.
Okay, let's ground that in a concrete example from our source material.
Yeah.
Imagine a simple 2x2 matrix. The top row is 3 and 1, the bottom row is 0 and 2. It's a set of instructions that stretches space.
Right, so when you run that matrix through the process of finding where the volume collapses, you end up discovering its eigenvalues are exactly 2 and 3.
Okay, so a 2 and a 3.
Yeah, that means this specific matrix has two fundamental directions where it doesn't rotate anything. It just stretches whatever is on one line by twice its length and whatever is on the other line by three times its length.
And, like, as a machine learning engineer, you might be thinking, great, I can stretch a rubber sheet. Who really cares?
Right. Why does this matter?
Exactly. But our sources highlight a few vital properties of these values that serve as critical sanity checks when you're actually writing code.
Oh, those sanity checks are lifesavers.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, if you take the trace of a matrix, which is just adding up the numbers down its main diagonal, that sum will always perfectly equal the sum of your eigenvalues.
Oh, okay.
Furthermore, the determinant of the matrix will always equal the product of those eigenvalues.
But why does a programmer care about that? Like, practically?
Well, imagine you're feeding a massive data set into an algorithm, and you need to know if your transformation is going to accidentally destroy information.
Right.
If you quickly calculate the determinant and it equals zero, you immediately know that at least one of your eigenvalues must be zero.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. That means your matrix isn't just stretching space, it's completely flattening a dimension of your data into nothingness. You've permanently lost features.
That's bad.
Very bad. Knowing those properties allows you to diagnose bugs in your data pipeline without having to run, you know, wildly expensive calculations.
It's kind of like checking the oil in the car before you try to drive across the country.
Exactly.
It also makes intuitive sense when you chain operations together. Like, if you raise a matrix to a power of 3, the eigenvalues are simply cubed.
Yep.
If you stretch that rubber sheet 3 times in a row, the arrow that doubled in length the first time is going to double, then double, then double again.
Right.
It's just elegantly simple.
It is. But, I mean, we have to admit, general matrices can be chaotic. They might not even have real eigenvalues.
Right. They can wander off into complex imaginary numbers.
Exactly. However, the good news for you, and really anyone working in machine learning, is that we very rarely deal with completely random, chaotic matrices.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. We usually deal with matrices that are highly structured, which brings us to the beauty of symmetric matrices.
Okay, so that's where the matrix is a perfect mirror image of itself across that main diagonal, like the top right perfectly matches the bottom left.
Precisely.
Yeah.
For symmetric matrices, the mathematical structure is incredibly clean, thanks to something called the spectral theorem.
Cool.
It provides three massive guarantees. First, it promises that all your eigenvalues will be strictly real numbers. No imaginary math to break your code.
Love that.
Right. Second, it guarantees that the eigenvectors corresponding to different eigenvalues will be perfectly orthogonal. They are at exact right angles to each other.
So they form like a perfect grid.
A perfect grid. And because of that perfect grid, the third guarantee is that we can completely decompose this symmetric matrix into three neat parts. A matrix of those orthogonal eigenvectors, a diagonal matrix of the eigenvalues, and then the inverse of the eigenvectors. It essentially pulls the transformation apart into its simplest components.
And that decomposition means the entire complex matrix can be rewritten as a simple sum of what we call rank one pieces.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I have to jump in here and push back a little.
Okay.
I get that the math is, you know, cleaner, but why should someone building a recommendation engine or a computer vision model actually care that a matrix is a sum of rank one pieces? What does that practically do for you?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, think about what a rank one piece actually represents. Each of those pieces is a completely independent orthogonal direction of your data multiplied by its eigenvalue, which acts as a volume knob.
A volume knob.
Okay. The spectral theorem is telling us that we can take a massively complex, tangled web of data and break it apart into clean, independent Lego bricks.
So it's almost like taking a full symphony orchestra recording
and
mathematically isolating the violins into one track, the trumpets into another, and the drums into a third.
That is a phenomenal analogy, and the eigenvalues tell you how loud each of those isolated tracks is.
Oh, wow.
It allows you to look at a data set and definitively say, 80% of the movement in this data is driven by this single rank one piece. You can isolate the core signal from the background noise.
Which leads us directly into the types of symmetric matrices we see all the time in practical ML covariance matrices.
Oh, yes, the big ones.
Right. Covariance is essentially just measuring how two different features in your data move together. Mm. Like if age goes up, does blood pressure go up?
Exactly. And to really grasp covariance matrices, we need to introduce the concept of positive definiteness.
Okay.
A symmetric matrix is positive definite if, no matter what non-zero vector you multiply it by, the resulting energy or variance is strictly greater than zero. Equivalently, it means all of its eigenvalues are strictly positive.
And if the eigenvalues are greater than or equal to zero, it's called positive semi-definite.
Mm-hmm.
The sources actually make a very firm point here. Covariance matrices are always positive semi-definite.
Because variance in the real world just cannot be negative. You can have zero variance if a data point never changes, but you can't have negative spread. You can't have less than zero uncertainty.
Right. And this isn't just some abstract statistical rule.
Mm-hmm.
One of the sources highlights a mind-blowing modern application of this. 3D Gaussian splatting, or 3DGS.
Oh, this is such a cool example.
It really is. It's a cutting-edge technique for rendering photorealistic, real-time 3D scenes. The covariance matrix in 3DGS defines the physical geometry of the scene, and it's built to be positive semi-definite by construction.
Because this is where the math literally becomes physical reality.
Right.
In 3DGS, you represent a 3D space using millions of tiny, semi-transparent, fuzzy blobs. Those are the Gaussians.
Right.
The covariance matrix defines the exact shape and orientation of every single one of those millions of blobs.
Yeah.
The scale parameters of those blobs, like how wide they are in the physical X, Y, and Z axes, those are literally the square roots of the eigenvalues of the Gaussian's covariance matrix.
So what does this all mean?
It means the linear algebra is acting as the literal physics engine of the 3D world. The eigenvectors tell the blob which direction to point in 3D space, and the eigenvalues tell it exactly how far to stretch.
That's wild.
If that matrix wasn't positive semi-definite, like, if an eigenvalue slipped into negative territory, the math would try to tell a physical 3D blob to have negative volume.
Which makes no sense.
Right. That wouldn't just look weird. It would mathematically crash the entire rendering engine. The eigenvalues are the geometry.
That completely reframes how I look at 3D graphics. It's just millions of little matrices stretching out.
Pretty much.
But let's pivot from 3D models back to general data structures.
Mm-hmm.
Because building on this idea of covariance, what happens when we aren't just looking at three dimensions, X, Y, and Z?
Right. Real data is huge.
Exactly. What happens when we have a data set with thousands of features, mm-hmm. and if we try to train a model on all of them, our laptop fans start screaming and the memory maxes out? How do we simplify the data without losing the actual story it's trying to tell?
That is the exact problem dimensionality reduction solves, specifically principal component analysis, or PCA.
Okay.
And the secret behind PCA is that it is just a direct application of the eigen decomposition we've been talking about.
Walk me through how an engineer actually sets that up. Let's say I have a medical data set, 10,000 patients, and for each patient, I have 500 different features. Blood pressure, heart rate, white blood cell count, cholesterol, you name it.
Okay, so you start by mean centering your data, which just means shifting everything so the average is zero. Then you calculate the sample covariance matrix.
So I'm finding how everything relates.
Exactly. You are measuring how every single one of those 500 medical features varies alongside every other feature. As we established, this massive 500 by 500 matrix is symmetric and positive semi-definite.
So the spectral theorem applies. We can break it down into our Lego bricks.
Precisely. We run an eigen decomposition. And here is where the pure math maps flawlessly to the machine learning task. The eigenvectors you calculate become your principal components.
Okay.
They are the new mathematically derived super features that best capture the spread of your patient's medical results. They represent the orthogonal directions of maximum variance.
And those eigenvalues, the stretch factors, they become the explained variance. They tell you exactly how much of the data set's total information is captured by each of those super features.
Yeah, so out of your 500 features, you get 500 eigenvalues. But when you look at them, you'll likely see that the first three or four eigenvalues are massive, and the remaining 496 are incredibly tiny.
Just tiny little blips.
Right. The math is explicitly telling you, hey, almost all the meaningful differences between your patients are driven by these top four super features. The rest is just random noise.
So I just project my massive data set onto those top four eigenvectors. I throw away 496 columns of data, drop the mathematical noise, and keep the core signal.
That's it.
Suddenly, my machine learning model trains in 3 seconds instead of 3 hours, and it might actually make better predictions because I stopped confusing it with irrelevant clutter.
That is the power of PCA. You are using linear algebra to distill the essence of your data.
Okay, I am totally on board with PCA, but I have a major structural pushback here based on how real-world data actually looks.
Hit me.
Eigen decomposition is incredible, but it strictly requires a square matrix. A 500 by 500 covariance matrix is square. But raw data is almost never square.
Very true.
Think of a recommender system for a streaming service. You might have a table of 10,000 users as rows and 50 movies as columns. That is a rectangular matrix. How on earth do we analyze the raw data directly if Eigen decomposition literally cannot handle a rectangle?
That is the exact wall data scientists hit, and it's why you have to reach for a different tool. The singular value decomposition, or SVD?
SVD, right.
SVD is the ultimate generalizer. It takes all the elegant concepts of Eigen decomposition, the orthogonal directions, the scaling factors, and adapts them to work on any matrix, no matter how wildly rectangular its shape might be.
So if SVD handles rectangular matrices, it must have a way to deal with the mismatched rows and columns independently, right?
You nailed it. Instead of one set of eigenvectors, SVD splits the matrix into three parts, U, sigma, and V transpose.
Okay.
The matrix U contains the left singular vectors, which handle the column space. So in your streaming example, they capture the underlying patterns among the users.
I see.
And the matrix V contains the right singular vectors, which handle the row space, capturing the hidden relationships between the movies.
Yeah, the sigma matrix in the middle.
That is a diagonal matrix containing the singular values. And they are intimately related to what we already know. The singular values are actually just the square roots of the eigenvalues you would get if you multiplied the matrix by its own transpose.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So the underlying mathematical engine is identical. It's just been brilliantly adapted for a rectangular world.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because you don't always want to keep all those singular values.
Mm-hmm.
The research discusses truncated SVD.
Yes, which is conceptually very similar to dropping the small eigenvalues in PCA. In truncated SVD, you only keep the top side or singular values and their corresponding vectors.
Okay.
And there is a profound mathematical guarantee here. When you do that, you get the absolute best low-rank approximation of your original matrix in what is called the Frobenius norm.
Okay, Frobenius norm is a piece of heavy jargon. What does that actually mean for the listener writing code?
Think of the Frobenius norm as the mathematical measure of closeness or error. It measures the average difference between the raw data and your new compressed approximation. Truncated SVD mathematically guarantees that for any given level of compression, it will give you the tightest, most accurate fit possible. It's like taking a giant 50 megabyte high resolution photo and finding the mathematically perfect way to compress it down to 5 megabytes so that the human eye can barely detect the difference.
And this is the absolute foundation for so much modern AI. When an early natural language processing model uses latent semantic analysis to figure out that the words bank and river are related.
Right.
Or when Netflix matrix factorizes your viewing history to recommend a sci-fi movie you've never heard of, they're using SVD. They throw away the blurry background noise of the small singular values to reveal the hidden, latent structures, like the underlying genres or concepts connecting the data.
It is arguably the most important decomposition in all of data science for uncovering hidden structures.
All right, but understanding the underlying structure of data is only half the battle. The other half of machine learning is training the models, running massive optimizations, and doing it all at scale in the cloud.
And that takes time.
Exactly, and that requires speed, because computing time is money. Eigen decomposition is mathematically beautiful, but it is computationally brutal. It runs in big O of n cubed time, meaning if your matrix gets 10 times bigger, the computation takes 1,000 times longer.
Yeah, it scales terribly.
If you try to run that on a massive data set, you will literally melt your hardware.
Which is why we need to discuss our final concept, the Teleski decomposition. You don't use Teleski to find deep geometric insights. You use it because you have a massive need for speed.
Okay.
Now, Teleski is a specialized tool. It only works on matrices that are positive definite. But when you have a PED matrix, Teleski allows you to tear it down into a lower triangular matrix multiplied by its transpose.
A lower triangular matrix meaning all the entries above the main diagonal are just zeros. It's essentially half a matrix.
Exactly. You can think of Teleski as the matrix equivalent of taking a square root. It strips the matrix down to its most efficient core.
But if Eigen decomposition reveals all those amazing principal components, why would an engineer ever choose Teleski instead?
because of the practical realities of software engineering. What's fascinating here is the sheer efficiency. Kaleski runs roughly 3 times faster than a full Eigen decomposition.
Wow, 3 times?
Yeah. If you are renting server time on AWS to train a model, a 3x speedup on your core matrix operations saves a massive amount of money. Furthermore, Kaleski is incredibly numerically stable. It rarely suffers from floating point rounding errors.
Give me a real-world scenario where that stability and speed are the difference between a model working and failing.
Okay, imagine you are programming a reinforcement learning bot, like an AI, trying to learn how to walk in a simulation. That bot has to sample data from a multivariate normal distribution millions of times every single minute to explore its environment.
Millions of times a minute.
Yeah. You cannot run an O of N cubed Eigen decomposition millions of times a minute. It would bottleneck the entire system. Instead, you use the Kaleski decomposition of the covariance matrix. It provides the exact mathematical structure needed to sample that distribution rapidly and stably.
The sources also mention it being used as a preconditioner. What does that actually mean in this context?
Well, when a neural network is training, it is basically trying to navigate a complex, bumpy mathematical landscape to find the lowest possible error.
Right, gradient descent.
Exactly. A preconditioner is a tool that smooths out that terrain. It reshapes the problem so the optimization algorithm can slide down the mountain faster instead of getting stuck in weird mathematical ravines.
Oh, that's clever.
Kaleski is frequently the hidden workhorse calculating that preconditioner. It is the high-performance racing fuel of optimization.
Well, looking back at the journey we've taken today, it is wild to see how these dense, abstract equations are so deeply physical. We've taken eigenvalues, SVD, and Kaleski, and revealed them as the actual algorithms allowing models to compress features, render lighting on 3D objects, and optimize AI training.
They really are the foundation.
They aren't just textbook formulas to memorize and forget. They are the literal code of modern artificial intelligence.
They absolutely are. And I think tracing this lineage from pure math to practical ML leaves you with a really compelling, provocative question to ponder.
Okay, what is it?
Today, we discussed how techniques like SVD are mathematically perfect ways to find the most informative linear structures in data. But as modern deep neural networks grow into massive, opaque black boxes with billions of parameters, it raises a question for you to explore on your own.
I like where this is going.
Are these giant deep learning models doing something entirely new and alien, or beneath all the hype, are they ultimately just learning highly complex non-linear approximations of these exact same linear algebra decompositions we've been talking about today?
That is a brilliant thought to end on. The invisible engine might just be getting vastly more complex, but the foundational mechanics, the stretching, the compressing, the isolating of signal from noise remain the exact same. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive. Next time you are importing a library or compiling a model for an ML project, take a second to look at your data matrices a little differently. See you next time.